This week, I was looking out the windows of our apartment. And I must not have paid attention before or something, because I noticed something that I really hadn't before. I observed a tug pulling a barge headed out of the Narrows on the north end, but it looked like it was standing still. When I looked again, and I saw that there was a good wake behind it, so it was obviously moving, but it wasn't making any progress. And then I looked at the direction of the tide and saw that it was coming in. So here was this tug, probably pulling with all its might, making very little progress. It must have taken about 15 minutes to move past the apartments. Well, that's a long time, because I could see it there. It took about 15 minutes or so. And then later that same day, I believe it was, I saw a tug coming in the other direction. Again, making very little progress. You might think it was standing still, except, again, there was a wake behind it. A pretty good one. This time the tide was going out. And again, the tug was pulling against the tide. Now, from an unlearned observer's viewpoint who knows nothing about why tugs go when they do, you know, it didn't make any sense. Now, why couldn't they wait until the tide was in their favor? All I could see was they were putting in a lot of effort and wasting a lot of energy to make very little progress. But, you know, now they were out there and they couldn't just stop, because to do so would mean to go backwards. And that's probably not a good thing with a huge barge behind. You know, so, and even to maintain position, to stay in one place, physically speaking, required them to do work. It's a lot of work to go against the current. Now, I realize this illustration isn't entirely analogous, but in a little way, is it perhaps similar to what Jesus' disciples experienced when the wind and storm came up on them on the Sea of Galilee? We've been working through the Gospel of John, and we're now at chapter 6, verses 16 through 21. This is the story immediately following the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 men and probably a total of 20,000 people. And as we discussed last week, after seeing the miracle, or the sign, as John puts it, the crowd and the disciples wanted to forcefully make Jesus king. Recognizing this, Jesus went away by himself, away from everyone. The parallel accounts in Matthew and Mark tell us that Jesus ordered his disciples to go into their boats and make their way to the other side of the lake. The intent, from what we can deduce, is that Jesus wanted them to go on ahead, and Jesus would meet them later, perhaps by walking along the shore. Jesus himself stayed behind to then dismiss the crowd. After the crowd was dismissed, he went up into the hills to spend some time in prayer. These events probably occurred sometime around early evening, when there was still plenty of daylight left for the crowd to return to their homes, or at least to find a lodging in the nearby towns for the night. John picks up the story after it had started to become dark. The disciples had not, in fact, made their way across the lake yet. They hadn't even gotten into their boats yet. The implication I get is that they were standing or sitting around on the shore, by the lake, waiting for Jesus to return. When the disciples finally come to the realization that, you know, Jesus really meant what he said, they get into their boats and begin to make their way across. They sail out for a while until the winds begin to become too strong for them and they are forced to let down their sails, and now they have to begin rowing to control their progress. The Sea of Galilee is 650 feet below sea level, 150 feet deep, and surrounded by hills. High winds can come down suddenly from the hills without warning and cause extremely high waves. This is what they were suddenly caught up in. At least some of the disciples were seasoned fishermen, fishing in this lake in the past. So I'm sure that some of them thought, now this was something they could handle. Now they've been through storms before. This was something they could handle. We don't know how long Jesus spent in prayer. We once again go back to Mark's recording of the story, and he tells us that Jesus saw the disciples struggling in the storm to keep control of the boat. Now, John tells us that they were 3 or 4 miles out in the lake, right in the middle of it. So Jesus was clearly seen, not with a physical vision, not with physical sight, but with supernatural sight. How long Jesus observed them, we're not told. What we do know from both Mark and Matthew's accounts is that no change comes about until the fourth watch of the night, which is somewhere around 3 in the morning. We don't know exactly when the storm came up or got bad, but we do know that the disciples were in the middle of the lake and were now in a struggle to stay afloat. And I was thinking about this, and they could have been rowing for as much as 6 or so hours in the storm, not making any progress. All their strength being used up just to stay in one place. You know, and who knows, maybe at this point they were ready to give up. And it's only then that Jesus makes his appearance to the disciples. Or could it be that this was when the disciples finally take the time to look? Mark's record includes an interesting little phrase. He, speaking of Jesus, meant to pass them by. A very similar phrase is found in Exodus when Moses asks to see God's glory. Moses is told that God will pass by, and a little while later, up on the mountain, God does indeed pass Moses by, and Moses gets a glimpse of God. God was with Moses in Israel all along, but when Moses takes the time to ask and look, God passes by to allow Moses a special look. Could it be that Jesus was with the disciples throughout the storm? Perhaps not physically, but in his capacity as God. And that it was only when the disciples began to lose confidence in themselves, when they perhaps began to think about an earlier storm where Jesus was with them, when they began to think about the signs that they had already seen performed by Jesus, when they began to realize that, you know, Jesus is God, the God of the Old Testament, of their scriptures, the only scriptures that they had, was it then that their eyes were finally beginning to open to the spiritual realities that was already present and surrounding them? It was then that their eyes were open to see Jesus. But what they saw, they didn't recognize. They became frightened when they saw this. When they saw this being walking on water towards them. Matthew and Mark tells us that the disciples thought it was a ghost. Jesus calls out to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Matthew, in his record, tells us that this is when Peter asks, "Is it really you? If it is, command me to come out on the water." And Jesus does. Peter takes a few steps, becomes afraid due to the waves, sinks, and Jesus comes to rescue him. And when the disciples finally recognize that this indeed is Jesus walking on the water, they welcome him into the boat. Matthew and Mark simply record that the storm calms down. John, however, records that they, with the boat, immediately reach their destination. Well, was this another miracle? Did they really suddenly find themselves transported from the middle of the lake to dry land in an instant? Or was it simply that John tells us that there were no other incidents between the middle of the lake in their travel to dry land? We don't really know. Whatever the case may be, the disciples, now with Jesus, reach dry land. John tells us that their original destination was Capernaum, but where they ended up was the town of Gennesaret, a little further down the coast than was originally intended. John, in writing this, recording these accounts, it was primarily to address issues and concerns that for the church facing the close of the first century. Most of them were already familiar with the records of Matthew and Mark. So when they heard or read John's account of this same story, they would have filled in the missing details with what they already knew, much like we've done today. And they would have understood that John was filling in important elements of the story that the other two accounts had missed. And any repetition that John made, they would have understood to be of particular importance. John's audience was second-generation Christians. These were Christians that did not have a direct physical encounter with Jesus and his works. At this point in time in history, they were no longer welcome at Jewish synagogues. Many were experiencing persecution for their beliefs. So what is John telling his audience through this story? One clue, I think, is found in the way John starts his retelling, "When evening came." John may be saying, "You've heard Matthew and Mark tell the story. We were commanded to go across the sea on our boat, but let me tell you something that you may not know. We didn't go immediately." On cursory reading, we might also think that Jesus, fully knowing that there would be a dangerous storm, sent the disciples into it. Now, why would he do that? John, in his account, is perhaps implying that this could have been an avoidable storm. Jesus knew that the storm was going to come, and he sent everyone away in time to make it across the sea before the brunt of the storm would hit. But the disciples apparently dallied around, perhaps several hours there. Why, we aren't told explicitly, but from the previous story, we can form an idea. The disciples may have been waiting for Jesus to return to try to convince him that it really would be best for him to be crowned king. They were so close to having their messianic vision fulfilled before it was really derailed by Jesus himself that perhaps they thought that with a little more persuasion, Jesus would acquiesce to their vision and plans for the future. But what happened instead was that things got dark. Not just physically, because the sun was going down, but their spiritual vision appeared to have darkened as well. John alludes to this by writing, "It was dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them." As we learned from earlier discussions in the Gospel of John, one of John's favorite themes is darkness and light. Spiritual darkness, and that the light, Jesus, comes to shine. And knowing that, I think it's safe to say that John is alluding here to that spiritual darkness. The disciples had lost Jesus. Their spiritual eyes could no longer see Jesus. They waited for their version of Jesus, the Jesus that they wanted, to come back to them. But he wasn't coming. So they resigned themselves and they go on their boats. Now in the dark. John doesn't mention what Jesus was doing at this time. From the other accounts, we understand that he was praying, but John doesn't mention any of that. But John instead goes immediately into describing how the sea becomes rough because of the winds. John seems to be saying to us, to his audience, that when Jesus is absent and darkness reigns, life can become rough and stormy. And what do people do when life becomes rough? According to John, the most frequent response is to start rowing more vigorously. People try to do all they can in their own strength to maintain course and to maintain control. The result, as John seems to imply, is that people end up in the middle of the storm, away from any help or hope, at least from the perspective of those in the storm. When everything seems to be hopeless, and people start to give up on themselves, on their own strength, on maintaining control, that's when, perhaps, they're finally ready to accept the help that God always wanted to provide and was always there for them. But John tells us even help can be mistaken for a threat. Even signs and miracles of God can be misunderstood if our spiritual visions are not clear. All three records of this story tell their readers that Jesus had to call out to the disciples, "It is I, and do not be afraid." The disciples were not expecting to see Jesus out in the middle of the lake. Even after they realized that their efforts at trying to save themselves were in vain and needed outside help, they still didn't expect Jesus to come to them. And perhaps John is telling his readers that because of their earlier failures in both attitude and action, they didn't think Jesus would want to be with them or would want to help them. John writes, however, that not only did Jesus come to them, but that he used the identifying phrase, "It is I," or more literally, "I am," to identify himself. "I am" is the name of God. The disciples would have recognized that phrase, that name, "I am," to be the God of the Old Testament. John is telling his readers that God himself came to help them. John, I believe, is telling his audience that it doesn't matter what you've thought or done, or not done. It doesn't matter how or why you've come to where you are. God is not going to abandon you. He is going to come and help and rescue you. If you'll accept the rescue and let him into your boat, your life, and the rest of the journey can happen as if it took no time at all. John's audience at the close of the first century must have been encouraged by these words. John wanted them to know that it doesn't matter what kind of storm you're facing. Maybe you had nothing to do with it, or maybe it was avoidable, but through some poor choices, you ended up in it. Or perhaps you were directly the cause of it. But regardless, God is there waiting to help and rescue. But he can't until you let him, until you stop trying to save yourself. You know, it's like water rescue when someone's drowning. You know, lifeguards don't try to grab the person, because what happens is that in their thrashing, the drowning victim can cause the rescuer to drown. Only until the drowning victim wants to be rescued can the rescuer safely rescue. That's why most lifeguards will try to hook them with a rope or use one of these other objects to try to bring them to the point where the drowning victim, the one drowning, realizes that, you know, there's help to be had. It may feel like God is absent, or you may even think that you don't deserve God's help. Just as Jesus kept his eyes on the disciples, God knows about your struggles. You might feel like you're about to perish, but God isn't about to let that happen. Now, at least spiritually, if you're willing to accept his strength and help, he's not going to let you perish. And I think John's readers understood that there's nothing to be afraid of. There's nothing in the future to be afraid of, because God is with them. God is with you. So here are a few things that I've learned from working through this story. Number one, there will be tests in this life. And it appears sometimes God does direct us right into them. There were multiple tests in this story and the previous one, the feeding of the 5,000. The disciples were faced with the test of learning to trust Jesus as provider. Then the disciples were faced with the test of having to give up their own messianic vision. And finally, they were faced with the test of learning to trust in God for their physical survival. God sent them into each of these tests. God may not necessarily cause the testing circumstances, but he knows what will happen, and he may direct us into some of them. Second thing is that some tests, I guess, are avoidable. Well, if we learn to trust from earlier tests and act on what we've learned, we may not have to go through some tests. Third thing, the primary purpose of tests of faith, at least as I get it, is for us to learn that God can be trusted. God can say as much as He wants that He loves us and that He can be trusted. But how can we really know that He can be trusted? Only when trust is put to the test. And so, in a sense, I guess, God too is putting Himself on the line. Tests of faith are a chance for us to see whether or not God is trustworthy. But we can only see that if we're willing to place ourselves on the line too. Number four, trust, I believe, is the basis of our relationship to God. Paul writes in Ephesians that husbands are to love their wives and wives are to respect their husbands. Now, this is an application of Paul's understanding of Christ's relationship to the church. And if that's true, and I believe it is, then love is the basis of God's relationship to us. But the fundamental basis of our response to God's love is perhaps trust. And that brings me to the final point, number five. We first have to fall in trust with God before we can fall in love with it. Once we know that God is trustworthy, we can learn to love and worship Him. Now, I've seen a number of recent news articles and reports stating that this world is experiencing a new spiritual hunger. Many people are discovering that, you know, there's something missing in their lives, and they're looking for spirituality in their lives. This is happening in what we often think of as, you know, a godless Western Europe. It's happening in the Americas. It's happening in China. People are searching for something more than what this physical world has to offer. But they're not looking for religion. Religion, in their experience, has proven untrustworthy. They're looking for something or someone to give their lives to, but they're looking for something or someone that can be trusted. The challenge for Christ's disciples, that's all of us here, the challenge for us in the 21st century is to show to the world the true God who is 100% trustworthy. Religions, and many claiming the name of religion, have unfortunately made this task much more difficult than it should be. But I believe that this generation of Christians, the true Christians, have been called to clear up that confusion. I believe we've been called to do that. But we can only do that if we ourselves believe that God is trustworthy. And perhaps that's why we're required to go through tests of faith. We must also show that we do live what we believe. But we can say all we want that we trust God, but it's our lives that show whether or not we truly believe what we say. We must show that we're not afraid to fall into God's arms. And again, that's why I believe God leads us into tests. Our families, our neighbors, our city, and the whole world is watching to see where they can find someone that is loving and trustworthy. Will they find that in you? Will they find it in me?